The first matter on this morning's calendar is the case of Mary Kay Strauss on behalf of her minor child versus Michelle Kitzmiller. When counsel for appellant is ready, you may proceed. And when all counsel reach the podium, please identify yourselves for us for the record.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, counsel, Ms. Strauss. My name is Bo McGraw, and I represent the appellant in these proceedings. Your Honors, this is a case about fairness, equality, a father's wish to have his children be treated equally in his memory, and a mother's fight for her daughter. We're here because the district court erred in its application of controlling law relative to the facts of this case. The controlling case that the district court used in analyzing this particular fact pattern is the Lemke decision. In the Lemke decision, we're given a standard. We don't have any legislative action involved in this case. We have a case that is a Supreme Court case which is controlling on these matters. And what that case tells us is that on this fact pattern, we need to review the fact pattern in the light of two considerations. Number one, whether the insured intended to change the beneficiary designation. And number two, whether the insured took affirmative action or otherwise did substantially all that he could do to demonstrate that intention. In this case, what you had is you had an individual that had a life insurance policy in the amount of approximately $300,000. He had two children. He had one child that was born a number of years ago, and he had another child that was born in 2015. What happened is, after a period of time, the mother in that case, Ms. Strauss, thought she needed some assistance to help care for the child. She was struggling financially, so she started a child support case, and she filed all the necessary paperwork. I think it shows in our brief she had difficulty even getting money together to file that paperwork, and she went to court. Mr. Clifton showed up at that court appearance, and he was represented by counsel. Now, his attorney showed up much later, and I think that record was developed at the district court. And what happened is my client had conversation with Mr. Clifton. It was a continuation of discussions that led up to that particular day. Mr. Clifton made it quite clear that he couldn't support a child support obligation, a guideline amount of $629 a month. He's looking for something different. He was looking to pay approximately $600 for both children. My client said, all we want to do is be treated fairly. But that's a really big ask. So what other things can we include in this agreement? So there were a number of other things included in the agreement, and the court makes reference to this. It was called a private agreement, and it was referenced by that child support magistrate and made a part of the overall agreement.
So is it true that the terms of that private agreement were not made a part of the record, either orally or as part of the written order? In other words, is there anything in the record reflecting that Mr. Clifton agreed to change the beneficiary designation on his life insurance policy?
Not that direct, okay?
I mean, there's reference to a private agreement.
There's reference to a private agreement.
But no description of the terms.
No description of the terms. However, we tried this matter in Dakota County, and the court determined that the first prong of Lemke,
understood,
which was there an agreement, the court determined that there was an agreement, and the court determined that this was the agreement. Number one, that child support would be $300, and that as a part of that agreement, Mr. Clifton was going to go to mother of first child and get her to acquiesce in this agreement and reduce the child support payment so he could have one payment of approximately $600. So what did he do after that court appearance? He made contact with mother for child one and reached agreement whereby she reduced her child support obligation so both children would be treated equally. We know that fact because the respondent admitted to that fact at trial in this case. It's a part of the transcript. What else did he agree to do? He agreed to help care for the minor child, Finley. Up until the point of that child support hearing, he wasn't all that active in Finley's care. He agreed to do that. What did he do after that hearing? Now, let's just provide a little bit of context here. This child support hearing took place on July 28 of 2015. Mr. Clifton's untimely demise, unexpected demise, occurred on August 31 of 2015. So we're talking about a month and a few days here, okay? So he agrees to be a part of Finley's life. He agrees to provide care so mom can go continue with her educational endeavors. Does he do that? He does. That was a fact that was proven as a part of our trial.
Mr. McGraw, can I clarify, did the trial judge tie in the reduction of child support in a finding to the life insurance desire, the desire to change? Was there a connection found by the trial judge?
The trial judge, the best I can tell, I didn't represent her at that hearing, but the best
I mean, at this, the underlying hearing here, you weren't representing it?
I was, and she did. Okay. The court did. The court said this was that private agreement. This was the reason that you gave up $329 a month in child support, because you reached this private agreement with Mr. Clifton.
But does the judge go on to explain what the purpose of the private agreement was, the goal as it relates to life insurance?
Life insurance was a part of the agreement. So if I can just keep going, I'll be as brief.
Let me ask this.
Yes.
Is there any indication in the record that the child support magistrate knew that the life insurance beneficiary designation was a part of the agreement?
There's nothing in the child support magistrate's record that would include that.
Or order.
No. But I think that goes to the first prong, with all due respect, Your Honor.
Okay. Let's go to the second prong, because the district court here found that the first prong was satisfied. There's been no notice of review seeking us to set aside that finding. So that's established. Now we have to ask whether the district court erred in determining that there was not a sufficient showing of affirmative action or substantial step to actually change the beneficiary designation. Why was that an error?
That error is because the court misapplied the law. The court read Lemke wrong. So in Lemke, the second prong, the Supreme Court of Minnesota determined that the second prong was satisfied by Mr. Lemke placing the letter in the mail whereby he names his two children as beneficiaries rather than his then wife. The placing of a letter in the mail, not to the life insurance provider, but to the new proposed beneficiaries, our Supreme Court said that was enough.
Do we have any similar action in this case? In other words, did Mr. Clifton put in writing to anyone his efforts to change the policy designation?
He didn't, but he made that clear. That goes to prong one. Prong one is, do we have the intent? We established that in a different way, not a letter, but at a courthouse, an agreement between two parties.
Let's leave prong one. We're leaving it. Established.
Yep.
What I'm saying is, you're saying, well, under Lemke, the outcome should be an equitable designation. But in Lemke, we had a letter. And we had a letter that the Supreme Court construed as something that the decedent viewed as like a will. So it was an attempt to make a change. What attempt do we see in this case to make a change in writing or otherwise?
So I believe Lemke, what Lemke said is that the letter is the intent, the placing of the letter in the mail is the substantial step. In this case, we have to take the overall agreement and analyze what happened. We're dealing with a little over a month. So what I wanted to establish was he went ahead and reached the agreement with his ex-wife.
But you've got to deal with the fact that the other side is saying, okay, here's an agreement, it's got four components. He complied, or he took steps to comply with three of those four, but no steps as to the life insurance. That just as well shows that he really wasn't going to make that change as otherwise.
I would disagree, and I don't think that's supported by the record. First of all, he did everything else that was asked to him as a part of the agreement. We're talking about a little over a month. We had another situation where Mr. Clifton agreed to make a change to his life insurance policy in his first marriage. He agreed, and the respondent in this case under cross-examination admitted that she used the same language. She said, Mr. Clifton and I agreed to a private agreement. I said, he designated your child as the beneficiary on that life insurance policy. How did that come about? Well, we reached that agreement in the context of my divorce case. I said, well, I've looked through your divorce decree. It's not in your divorce decree. Did you reach a private agreement? She said we did.
Counsel, the standard requires a showing that there's been affirmative action or a substantial step to make the change. Do we have that here?
We do.
What's the affirmative action or substantial step to change the beneficiary designation?
Everything he did as a part of this overall agreement supports a finding that he took substantial steps. Absolutely.
But did he take, I mean, he didn't take any steps to make the beneficiary change.
He didn't have time to do that.
Okay.
Well,
I would submit.
In Lemke, how soon after the letter was sent did Lemke die?
He died, I think he died the day he put the letter in the mail.
Okay. And isn't that a significant factual distinction between this case and Lemke?
I don't think so. I think the difference between Lemke and this case on that issue is that the intent and what the court determined the substantial step were so close together because he simply placed it in the mail. But you could have made a number of arguments that he could have done more to change that he didn't do. Placing a letter in the mail versus everything that the decedent did in this case, the decedent in this case, I would submit to this court, did much more.
But he didn't do anything related to the life insurance policy designation.
He did everything related to the party's agreement, though, Your Honor. And because it was a month and 3 days before he passed, he didn't have time to deal with the life insurance issue.
Why not? I mean, didn't someone testify that it's a change that could have been made online on a computer?
It's a change that could have been made. It could have been made. I would ask you just to put yourself in his position. He's a healthy individual. He's a firefighter. Is he thinking that I've got to change?
And I understand. And no one, including the district court, is arguing that that may have been his intent. It was his intent. But the law requires that some action be taken to implement that intent, and I understand he maybe didn't realize that it was imminent. He maybe didn't realize that he should have acted. But the bottom line is we're left with a record where he didn't do anything specific to that term of the private agreement. In other words, he didn't write anyone, contact anyone, call anyone saying, hey, I'm calling to make this change. And doesn't that kind of second, it seems to me, that what you're asking us to do is sort of ignore the second part. You keep saying, well, all of this shows that he intended to do this. Okay. Well, that's the first step. He actually then needs to do something to implement his intent, and that seems to be lacking. For whatever reason, and for reasons you validly explain, but it's still lacking.
And I think for my client to have success on the second prong, the court needs to look beyond that particular part of it, and the court needs to understand the agreement in total and the steps that he took to comply with that agreement, and the court needs to have a willingness.
So we'd have to say, because he took steps to comply with these other three terms that have nothing to do with changing the designation on his life insurance policy, we're going to construe those steps as a substantial step to change his life insurance policy beneficiary designation.
I think it's a totality of the circumstances analysis. I think the court needs to look at everything that was done in reliance upon the agreement that they reached at the courthouse.
In looking at the case law on the standard, specifically the second fact, I see every case on the second step involves someone doing something. They wrote to somebody. They called their insurance provider. You know, they did something, but for whatever reason, it wasn't enough to make the change happen. And I'm just not seeing that anything was done to initiate the change here, other than agreeing to make the change, which isn't enough because that only goes to the first step of the test.
And I would respectfully disagree. I think based upon a totality of the circumstances, knowing that he passed a month and 3 days after this agreement was reached. And the other thing is, if we look at the history of the decedent, when he reached this agreement that I was touching on before with the respondent, it took him a year and a half to change that beneficiary designation. This was not an individual that did anything within that month and 3 days to suggest that he wasn't going to do everything he had to do to change that agreement.
But that's not the standard.
You can look at it as a totality of what occurred here. And I think it's fair to look through this as a lens of...
What you just said is important, because what you're asking us to say is, well, there's nothing in the record to indicate he wasn't going to do this. And that may be true, but that's far different than the standard, which says he has to take affirmative action or substantial steps to make the change.
I think my argument's a little different than that. I think my argument is everything in the record supports that he was going to make the change, because all the things that he did consistent with that agreement that he reached at the courthouse.
Understood.
Thank you. Unless there's any other questions?
We'll give you an opportunity for a rebuttal if you wish.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Brian Vitus. I represent the respondent, Michelle Kitzmiller, on behalf of her minor child, Elise Clifton. As this court recognized, the trial court set forth the correct legal standard in this case. The two-part test announced by the Minnesota Supreme Court in Brown v. Egan and Lemke v. Schwartz is clear that two things must be satisfied for a court to award life insurance proceeds to a beneficiary other than that named in under the life insurance policy. First is that you need to show intent, and we've discussed that, and the district court has found that there was intent to change the beneficiary. But more importantly, in what this district court focused on and emphasized in its order and in italics was the second part of that test. And the second part of that test states that the insured took affirmative action or otherwise substantially did all that he could do to demonstrate that intention without regard to whether he complied with the change of beneficiary provisions in the policy. The court in its order found that there was no evidence to support the second prong. Specifically quoting, during the hearing, there was no intention on the record or in the child support order of adding Finley as a beneficiary. Following the child support hearing, no evidence was provided that decedent made an attempt to contact his employer or to make any changes to his policy, despite contacting his employer to make changes to his health insurance policy. To make such a change would have been a relatively simple process, as credibly explained at trial by Ms. Mosquera, decedent's human resources provider, end quote. That was on page 2 of the trial court's memorandum.
Mr. Vitus, yes. Would it be fair to characterize the first prong as the critical prong? Because obviously in all these cases, as we get to prong 2, there's never a change in beneficiary. Of course, that's why we're all here. So then we're just looking at the steps. Wouldn't in most cases the biggest hurdle for a plaintiff in a case under this standard to show the intent, because that's the key finding, which is contrary to the written life insurance beneficiary designation. And then we simply, under prong 2, look to steps without regard to whether he complied with the change of beneficiary. So everything short of that. And here it seems like there's a number of steps pointed out by the appellant, including the adding in the, for health insurance, as I recalled, the understanding of the private agreement, and it all happened during a short period of time. Is my characterization of those prongs different than how you would look at that?
Because I think the characterization is correct. I think that without intent, you can't go to the second part of the test. So you need to first establish that there's intent. The district court established that there was intent here based on a private conversation between the plaintiff and the decedent. No other testimony was received because that was a private conversation, and there was no way really to corroborate or to contradict that agreement that was made. That being said, there's still a second part of this test the plaintiff must show that there was some sort of action taken by the decedent insured to carry out that intention. Here we do not have that. We have the decedent going to before a child support magistrate and trying to lower the child support payments that the guidelines suggested from $629 to $300 per month. But at that hearing and in the order, there was no mention of the life insurance policy whatsoever. And this is critical because the magistrate at that hearing was struggling to find a reason for the downward deviation. Yet none of the attorneys or the parties raised any issue about the life insurance policy. They could have put that on the record. They could have said that as a condition for the downward deviation, the decedent must add Finley to his life insurance policy.
If that had happened, would that make a difference in our analysis?
I think that could have made a difference in that analysis. There is case law discussing divorce decrees and dissolutions and adding that component. And courts have decided that because that was put on the record and it was binding, that did establish that second part of the two-part test.
So the case law treats a person's acknowledgement in court on the record of intent to follow through with this as a substantial step.
And I think because it's a binding part of, and it's a judicial decree.
It's something that could be enforced
correct.
By the court.
Correct.
But we don't have any record of his agreement. I mean, we have the district court saying, okay, I believe you. He told you off record he would do this, but we don't have anything on the record where Mr. Clifton said, yes, I'm going to do this. This is part of the agreement.
No, we don't. We have nothing written, no memorandum, no papers, no estate planning documents, nothing whatsoever. And another important part of
this. So it is conceivable, you know, one could argue, well, viewing this evidence, yes, he told mother this to get a deal on child support, but he really didn't intend to follow through with it.
That's correct. And that's why it's important here to show that second part is to show how he carried out that intention. Here, he some days after that child support hearing, he went to his employer and talked to the HR benefits manager, Mrs. Mosquera, and talked to her because he wanted to add Finley to his health insurance policy. But Ms. Mosquera testified at trial that at no point during that discussion did he raise any issue about how he could add Finley to his life insurance policy.
But isn't that a different insurer?
Doesn't
the record suggest that the process for changing, for adding a beneficiary to his health insurance was very different than changing the beneficiary designation on his life insurance policy?
Yes, it's slightly different. It was actually easier to change the life insurance policy than the health insurance. He could have just logged into the system, which he had done previously on a number of occasions prior to this. And as the HR benefits manager testified, that the process was very simple. It was just a matter of logging into the system, clicking a button, and adding Finley to his policy. But that was not done. He never logged into the system. He didn't inquire from the HR benefits manager how to do that. She stated that there was no mention of that, even though he was doing that, and it would have been a perfect opportunity for him to carry out that intention, but he didn't do that. I also like to discuss counsel's argument about the private agreement appellant is saying that because the decedent followed through on A, B, and C of the private agreement, well, then he was going to follow through on D, which was adding Finley to his life insurance policy. But a reasonable interpretation of that would be that, yes, he did do A, B, and C, but he didn't follow through with D because he never was going to. And that is a critical component that this court should consider, is that he didn't do that, that there's nothing in the record showing that he was going to follow through on adding Finley to his life insurance policy.
Mr. Edis, on that point, I wonder, are we giving undue focus on the touch of the finger, how quickly he could have changed it? Because, again, if he would have, we wouldn't be here. But given the short time period between the time of the agreement, the child support hearing, and when he died, it's my understanding on the record, it does show his increased active involvement with Finley's life, the health insurance. Aren't those the sort of circumstantial evidence that gets to the point of an equitable consistency with an intention that's unrefuted here? I intend to change, but he dies a little over a month later, but he's more involved with the child's life. There's the health insurance change, which appears to be unrefuted. Isn't that the sort of evidence that's circumstantial to be consistent with then adding the life insurance if he would have lived beyond the one
yeah,
month?
Yeah, I understand that argument, but I don't think that's what the test is and what was set forth by Minnesota Supreme Court. I think the test was, one, you have to show intention, and two, you have to show some affirmative act by the decedent as to how he tried to carry out that intention. Here we don't have that. Yes, we have him doing three things, but those three things are not related in any so fashion to adding Finley to the life insurance policy. The very fact that he didn't shows that he he didn't really have an intention to add her to the policy.
I'm sorry. I don't know. I don't think that argument is really appropriate at this stage because we have a finding from the district court that he intended to make the child his beneficiary. No one is challenging that finding in this appeal. The only question in this appeal is whether or not he took steps that were substantial enough or affirmative steps to change the beneficiary, to actually follow through and implement his intention. His intention is not being challenged.
That's correct, Your Honor. However, there hasn't been a showing, as the district court stated in its memorandum, that there's been anything done to establish the second part.
I understand that, but I think that's where the focus of the argument should be, not on what he intended.
Sure.
I mean, the court found that he intended to make the child his beneficiary.
Sure. In an examination of the case law, as this court recognizes that all of the cases, there is some sort of affirmative act taken by the insured to carry out that intention, whether it's a letter sent in Lemke, whether there was an application to try to make a change to the beneficiary designation. We don't have that here. We have no evidence whatsoever of any acts taken by the insured to try to add Finley to his life insurance policy, and that is key here. If this court were to reverse this decision and base the decision solely on a private agreement between the parties, it's essentially abrogating the second part of this two-part test, and there would be no requirement to show any affirmative act in carrying out that intention.
Is your point, Mr. Vitas, that it has to be, in acknowledging a 1979 decision, that it has to be, the act has to be directly related to changing the beneficiary? So arguably in 1979 versus now, instead of going on the computer, you'd fill out a form, an application that gets mailed to the company, but it hasn't been processed before he dies. Is that how you read that?
That's how I read it. And in Lemke, he was essentially on his deathbed, and he wrote a letter, and he wrote it as his last will and testament. And the court in Lemke found that he did all that he could substantially do at the time, considering the context of there's no computers at that time, that he was on his deathbed. He actually died that night. And he sent that letter in, and really that was the only thing he could do considering the circumstances. There was no computer where he could have logged. Maybe it would have been different now where he could have logged on to his health insurance, to his life insurance provider and changed that designation instead of send a letter. But at the time, that's all that he could have done considering his health.
How does that differ from the finding, because they found that was his intent. It wasn't a will under the probate. It was simply a written statement. How does that differ from here, where the judge, that's unrefuted, found the intention, but he dies more than a day, of course.
Right, and I think the key distinction there is that the court does state that whether or not it was a valid will, he believed it to be his last will and testament, and it was a legally significant act. That is what accomplished and satisfied the second part of that two-part test. In that case, it was kind of both, right? The letter showed his intent, but it also showed an act of him delivering this letter and trying to establish it as his last will and testament, and he thought that it had legal significance in changing the beneficiary and distributing the life insurance proceeds to someone other than his wife. That's all I have for you this morning, unless you have other questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Thank you. I have a couple points I'd like to make. First of all, the discussion in the middle of August with the HR individual, she testified at trial. Her testimony included this. She was asked questions about whether or not he could have had discussions with her about changing the life insurance beneficiary. She says, even if he had, we would not have done that. The city, I can't speak for all employees, we do not name or change beneficiaries. People need to do that themselves. By all accounts, Mr. Clifton was a fair and decent man. Why would he want to treat his two children any differently? I've been thinking a little bit about the questions I received on the first part of my argument here. My client was not represented by an attorney when she went to this child support hearing. Mr. Clifton was. I wish my client was. This could have been made a part of the court record, okay? But here's what we have. Counsel talks about legal significance, that Lemke thought that it was legally significant that he drafted a letter that took on a form of kind of like a last will and testament, and that he had sent that to his children. He thought there was legal significance. In his mind, that was probably enough to change this beneficiary designation. If you look at what happened in this case, we've got the agreement between my client and Mr. Clifton. They agreed that this was going to be a part of their overall child support agreement. The district court found that. So what happens next? What's that substantial step? Here's
What do you mean the district court found that?
The district.
Where in the district court findings is there a reference to any quid pro quo with respect to naming the child a beneficiary on the life insurance policy?
Well, I think Judge Simonette found in her order that they had an agreement. There was an attempt to change his beneficiary designation.
Okay, I misunderstood. I thought
that's
you were talking
prong
about
one.
The child support.
No. I wish we had that, but we don't have that. Okay, so but we have that intent finding. Okay, so they reach an agreement. My client and him reached an agreement. What if they reached that agreement not at the courthouse? What if they reached that agreement having coffee at Starbucks? We have that. They have an agreement. Then my client comes into a courthouse and tries to prove later that we had an agreement and then talks about steps he may or may not have taken after that. Here we have the substantial step. Not only did they reached the agreement at a courthouse, and it said on that record that he agreed to be bound by the private agreement. That's what that record shows. There's the substantial step. We're not talking about putting a letter in the mail and mailing it to your children. We're talking about receiving.
So you're saying he went on the record and said, I agreed to be bound by a private agreement, the terms of which are undisclosed.
It says the parties reached a private agreement at the courthouse. They agreed to be bound by those. Not only did they reach it, but there was legal significance to it because they agreed on a court record to be bound by it. And of course, if she had
think of another example in law where someone is held to an agreement in court under those circumstances. You're bound to your agreement, the terms of which are not disclosed to the court.
But that goes to prong one. The court determined what Judge
okay,
Simonette.
But you keep going back to that as satisfying prong two.
No, what satisfies prong two, Your Honor, with all due respect, is not that they reached the agreement, but that he agreed to be bound by that agreement in a courthouse.
But
that's why prong two is satisfied.
Bound by the agreement without also going on record to say what it was. So how much is he really agreeing to? You're telling the judge, I agree to something, but I'm not telling you what the terms are. How binding is that on someone?
I don't know why the child support magistrate didn't want to flesh that out. I know probably why Mr. Clifton's attorney didn't want to flesh that out.
But none of that is relevant. What I'm asking is, are we really to find that someone is purporting to bind himself over to the court to do something when the something is in no way, shape, or form disclosed to the court?
I believe the case law supports this court making that determination. I think the court can say that there was an agreement because the district court already found it. The substantial step in furtherance of that agreement was him agreeing to be bound by it on a court record. Why it wasn't fleshed out is not something my client should pay a penalty for. Unless there's other questions, I don't have any more comments.
No further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. The matter has been well argued, and it is taken under advisement.